They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA Podcast. Outside the bubble, but we're going to go inside the bubble, back inside the bubble for this podcast to bring in my good friend Dan Wojcicki, LA Times national NBA writer. He is in there for the back half experience of the bubble. And Dan, before we start, I have to admit something to you.
Okay.
During your quarantine week, if you periodically heard a banging on your window, that was me.
That was you, right? I thought that was you. I wasn't 100% sure. It was a horrible room to be quarantined in, but it's been a great room to stay in. Like, I've got an excellent courtyard pickleball view from my room, where the refs all play pickleball, which has now become a thing that the media is playing pickleball too. Like, we all really like it. But when you're quarantined here, like, you're just staring out at it and people can stare right back in. People would watch me periodically do my morning walks during quarantine, which was I'd walk from my window to my bathroom sink back and forth, for, I don't know, like 2 straight hours.
Yeah.
Ballpark it and like you look like a crazy person. Now that I have this, I have the freedom to come and go from my room, I really do appreciate the first floor experience, even if it came at the cost of you being a total jerk and knocking on the window and taunting me.
You made the mistake of letting me see where you were staying. Nobody else made that mistake. If they had, I would have been at Rosenberg's door or Amick's door or any of them, but I swatted you, so I had to, every time I went in there to get myself an ice cream sandwich, I came back out, walked past, bang, bang,
I'm very
bang,
close.
Bang, bang.
Yes. I'm very close to the ice cream sandwich stand. Yes. No, yes. It's funny. So, you know, as someone who was here and isn't, I think you would be surprised at the gentrification of the bubble that's happened since we've gotten here. The fact that, you know, we have a beautiful television in the media dining room, the fact that, you know, we have access to a sports bar now. We have access to a hallway to get to the convention center where the practices are instead of having to walk outside. It really has been, since you've left town, just, you know, a much better place to live.
I wonder if those two things are connected. It's unclear.
It feels like they might be.
All right. A few things I want to get to with you, Dan. I want to start with the MVP voting. Last week, Giannis Antetokounmpo won his second straight MVP. This was expected, with Antetokounmpo putting up some historic numbers during the regular season and the Bucks finishing with the best record in basketball. Giannis finished with 85 first place votes to LeBron's 16. That number clearly irked James, who had this to say about the voting.
Pissed me off. That's my true answer. It pissed me off because out of 101 votes, I got 16 first place votes. That's what pissed me off more than anything. Not saying that the winner wasn't deserving of the MVP, but that pissed me off.
So LeBron is not happy, Dan. I'll ask you this. Does he have a legitimate beef?
Legitimate to who? I think he believes what he said. I think, you know, to me, I think, let's start with this. The notion that if he would have gotten 10 more first place votes, you know, and still lost, I think he'd still be upset, right? If it was instead of 16, say 26, or if it was instead of 26, even 30, you know, like, I think LeBron is obviously an incredibly competitive person, an incredibly competitive player. And he thinks he's the best player in the league. So I don't know that there's any number of first place votes that he could have gotten and still finished second where he would have been satisfied, for starters, right? So I really don't think it's about the disparity so much. I do think, though, here's what I left the room thinking, Chris. I left the room thinking about James Harden. And I left the room thinking about the way James Harden talked about Giannis. And, you know, having been here and seeing the Bucks get eliminated, you know, without much of a fight, to be totally honest, you know, Giannis' ankle injury notwithstanding. Like, I think people think he's a great player, but I don't know that his peers view him as a winning player necessarily. There's really no reason to. And so to me, I want that. I left thinking about Giannis and being like, you know, this is pretty disrespectful in that sense. And that tells me kind of, you know, where Giannis stands among his peers. That was my original thing. Should LeBron have gotten more votes for first place? I mean, knowing what we know now, yeah, absolutely. But I think, look, the arguments for which he stated what the MVP could be, you know, does it go to the best player? They got the best stats. Does it go to, you know, someone on the best team? Yeah, both those guys were Giannis.
Yeah.
like Giannis had the best stats. He played for the team with the best record. You know, he was the defensive player of the year. We don't vote at the LA Times. I would have voted for Giannis. And yeah. I would have done so pretty easily.
Yeah. I voted for Giannis, Dan, and I voted, and it really didn't – I didn't sweat the vote, put it that way. I was incredibly impressed, like everybody else, about what LeBron did, but I didn't sweat this vote. We don't have to run through all the stats Giannis put up, but in many areas, they were historically good. You mentioned the defensive player of the year. He was also on the best team in the NBA, and I would argue that – you know, people point to how quickly the Bucks were eliminated as being an argument against Giannis. I kind of looked at it a different way. I mean, Giannis doesn't have an Anthony Davis. He's got a Chris Middleton, who's good, and he's got some solid supporting role players that help that team become a great defensive team. But I think we've seen in these playoffs, particularly in game two of this series, exactly how valuable and Anthony Davis is. And, you know, LeBron has the luxury of having another player that, you know, as we've seen with the All-NBA voting, is a top five type of guy. So any great player believes they're the best player. I don't have a problem with that. But any kind of public debate shouldn't really exist. Like, Giannis, it's a regular season award. Giannis was by far and away, I thought, in every category you need to be high in, by far and away the best player. I don't think there's much in way of dispute. I certainly don't think it's what LeBron said, where he's like, there is some, you know, people like the narrative. I mean, who's big on the Milwaukee Bucks now?
Here's the thing, right? Like, so the narrative arguments are almost all entirely for LeBron. Like, if you want to pull back and say, okay, like, what does this award really mean? What does value truly represent in this league? Okay, well, like, you have LeBron James playing some of the best basketball of his career late in his career. You've got a guy who shepherded the Lakers through a season-beginning controversy in China, one that he actually made a little worse, certainly. But, you know, he helped keep that team together through that, helped keep them together through an unthinkable tragedy. And the death of Kobe Bryant, he helped, you know, kind of navigate that stuff. And I think, look, if LeBron really wants to be mad at something about, you know, the MVP award, he should be mad at the coronavirus, because had the season continued for another month, you know, Giannis was slowing down, he had been injured. The Lakers were really hot. They had just come off those wins, you know, over the Bucks and the Clippers. And they seemed to be kind of really ramping up. And if LeBron had a great last month, he may have won the award, truly, because maybe they overtake the Bucks for the best record in the NBA, or, you know what I mean? Or something like that happens. Maybe Giannis slows down and ends up only playing 68 games or 70 games, and LeBron plays, you know, 80. I think the stoppage certainly hurt his candidacy. But to me, like, the argument for LeBron is, like, almost – it's largely narrative-based. And those things do matter, right? And that doesn't mean they're not true, and it doesn't mean that they're not important. It doesn't mean that he's not valuable or incredibly valuable. I think in a lot of years, you know, the season that LeBron James had was absolutely MVP worthy. I think just this season, statistically speaking, Giannis's numbers were better. The team he was on, you know, ended up playing better. And I agree, he did so with less help. You know, so that's probably why I would have voted Giannis, not sweated it either. But it's not in no way is it like a shot at like what LeBron accomplished this season. Like LeBron is, you know, a unanimous all NBA player. Like this is somebody, if you don't think he had one of I couldn't think of anybody credibly voting him third, right, Chris? Like it's either, right. I mean, yeah, like it was either him or Giannis this season. And to me, like that choice isn't a super easy choice, but it also wasn't like a super difficult one either.
No, and if he's got a, you know, I understand it's frustrating finishing second. If he's got a gripe about a second place finish, it's probably 2011 when Derrick Rose won the MVP. Back then, I think everybody believed LeBron was the best player in basketball. I think there was some LeBron fatigue off of, you know, going to Miami and everything that happened prior to that. One thing I'd like to say, too, about Giannis not being a winner or not being thought of as a winner, you're not a winner until you are. Right. Yep. I mean, how many years did we look at LeBron as not being a winner? How many
Michael
years
Jordan.
Did we? I was going to say that was next. Michael Jordan not being a winner. I mean, he spent like 7 years as a scorer and not a winner. Even Kobe, you know, post Shaq, can he win? Is he a winner without, you know, the best big man and one of the best in basketball history? I mean, Giannis is too young and it's too short of a time going deep into the playoffs to make any assumptions about his ability to win, right? Like he has got plenty of years, or at least a few more anyway, to, you know, to give you enough evidence to form a real opinion about whether he's a winner or not.
Yeah, I just wonder sometimes if like and this sounds kind of dumb, and so I apologize already. I just wonder if like other people think of him as like a hooper. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't know if that's because, you know, he's a foreign-born player, which certainly does carry some stigma in the league still. I don't know if it's because, you know, he is like this sort of like lab-type basketball weird body who has these skills but is super tall and ends up can just like sort of run through people and dunk in all these weird sort of contortions. And people view it, but he's not a great shooter. So people say that maybe he's not as skilled. I don't know if it's that. I just feel like, you know, obviously we saw what James Harden said. I would bet, you know, that if you like gave LeBron like a lot of truth serum, you'd hear something similar. That like, I just think there's like there's a purity that, you know, that doesn't exist in Giannis's game, like a pure like sort of skill, a pure. You know, and because he's a guy who's improving and he's doing it so rapidly, it's tricky. I agree with you. I mean, I think labeling him as a guy like, oh, he can't get a team over the hump. Like, you're right. Like, I mean, he's been like a true star in the league for what, like 4 seasons?
Mm-hmm.
Like these things take time, for sure. And as soon as you win one, as we'll talk about later, like it only takes one and then you're a winner.
You know? And I mean, and LeBron needed better players around him to become a winner. That's not a knock. It's just the truth. Michael Jordan needed a different coach in Phil Jackson to become a winner. And he needed Scottie Pippen to come into his own to do that. So mm-hmm. I think we got years to figure out the Giannis conversation. All right, let's turn to the other LA team here, Dan. The Clippers are done. Bounced in the second round after blowing a 3-1 series lead to the Nuggets. This was a team that began the postseason among the favorites to win the championship. Instead, it ends with Paul George saying this.
But, you know, it is what it is. It's no cop-out. Fact of the matter is we didn't live up to that expectation. But I think internally we've always felt this is not a championship or bust year for us. You know, we can only get better the longer we stay together and the more we're around each other. The more chemistry for this group, the better. I think that's really the tell of the tape of the season. We just didn't have enough time together.
All right, so it wasn't championship or bust this season, Dan, for Paul George anyway. What, if anything, will be the fallout to this second-round loss for the Clippers?
Well, I mean, I think there'll be a lot of fallout, actually. You know, and I think a lot of it has to – it starts with sort of looking at the way the roster is constructed and asking yourself, like, can we move forward with this, like, leadership structure among our players? Like, is this good enough? Now, Chris, I think as someone who's been in the bubble and I've been here, you know, a little bit of time, it does feel like a weird scenario to come out of this and be making really drastic decisions. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, this is a place where, like, weird things happen. You know, like, there's almost nothing worse than being up 19 points in the bubble because the other team's going to play zone and you're going to freak out. And like, you know what I mean? Like, like we've seen this happen so many times. Like, you're going to miss a bunch of jump shots. You're going to get super tight. And you're going to lose. Or you're going to blow a lead. Or you're going to almost blow a lead. It just feels like a place where I don't know how replicable any of this is. That being said, it still all counts, right? And this was one of essentially two guaranteed years that the Clippers have of Paul George and Kawhi Leonard together. And it ended with them blowing, gosh, I'm not even doing the math anymore. What was it, like 40? I think 47 points of leads in the last three games?
Yeah,
something like that. So 19, 16, and 12, I think. So blowing those types of leads, doing it in sort of this spectacular fashion over and over and over again, to me, it speaks. So they needed someone on the court to not lead with actions, to lead with words too, and say like enough. And you know, for lack of a better term, like they needed their Kyle Lowry. And that guy was Patrick Beverley for the Clippers for most of the year, was like sort of the vocal person, but like I don't think he's as level headed enough of somebody or certainly not prolific enough as a player to like have that leadership voice like fully carry the weight that it needs to. And I think that's part of the reason why you saw what you saw is you have the best player on the team is a guy who's going to be unaffected in his demeanor no matter what is happening around him. He is the cartoon dog in the burning fire with the I'm fine. like that is exactly – he is the same, good or bad or whatever, right? And that's what makes Kawhi Leonard – part of the reason why he's so great is like that he's unflappable. But like they needed to be flapped in this situation. Somebody needed to step up and say something. And look, we saw Paul George wasn't comfortable with it. He tried. We saw him try to project calm post game and was routinely mocked for it. I don't know who this player is, Chris. I don't know what the move is going to be, but I mean, I think you have to look at your roster, and knowing what's happening in the West, knowing what's going to happen with Golden State next season. I think you're going to have to say, like, are we good enough as constructed? To quote, run it back? Or, you know, do we have to do something a little more drastic? Do we have to become even more further leveraged into our future and give up even more of our assets to try and make a splash because the time is now? And, I mean, look, I think it's one of those things, like in for a dime, in for a dollar, and the Clippers are definitely in for a dime. you know what I mean? Like there's a 12-year-old walking the streets, Chris, listening to this podcast, who may someday be drafted with one of the picks that the Clippers traded for Paul George. So, yeah, it was championship or bust. They committed a decade of the franchise's future for this, and now they're going to have to go even deeper into the hole to try to figure out a way to pull some success out of this. But I think, like Doc Rivers said it, like this team ran from being great. They had so many opportunities. It's going to be a really interesting sort of autopsy internally to see what they decide to do, especially considering their options aren't all that great.
No, they're not great. And the chemistry issues that were talked about at the very end, as you know, were not unique to the bubble. I mean, you go back to, you know, midseason, I think it was Harrell who said publicly, like, yep, we're not as good as we think we are, you know? So this was something that had been percolating going all the way back to mid-season before the pandemic. All that being said, and maybe it is because They don't have a lot of great options. I wouldn't do anything if I was the Clippers. I would dig deep into Steve Ballmer's money bin, and I'd bring back Montrezl Harrell. I'd do what it takes to bring back Marcus Morris. I'd spend my exceptions on players that I think can help me win, even if the cost of those players is exorbitant based on what they mean for the luxury tax. I just think this bubble experience was so different. And the Clippers were one of the most adversely affected teams in the bubble because of the shuffling in and out of the lineup, none of which excuses what they did. I mean, the Nuggets had as many problems as the Clippers coming into all this, and they still rallied and came together from down 3-1 to beat them. But I don't think you can use the end of this season as a referendum on this group. I don't know that they win next year, but I don't think that this season can be looked at as evidence of what this team can be. I do think, Dan, that next year is the biggest year in the history of the Clippers franchise. I really believe that. Next year, it's championship or bust. Like, you can't say otherwise, because to your earlier point, the contract situation with Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, they can opt out after next year. Doc Rivers now has blown a couple of 3-1 leads in series that you should have expected him to win. You know, I've had people say to me, you know, Doc's taking this team exactly as far as Vinny Del Negro. So Doc has got to win with this group as well. If they don't win next year, you might have to blow this whole thing up. And then you go into a long rebuild if you're the Clippers. But I think their best chance of winning next year, if this makes any sense, is bringing this group back together.
Yeah, I think that look, that's certainly – and it's a good option, right? Like, it really actually is a good option to do. You could say, you know, the Clippers never were together this season. The chemistry that they never had was a byproduct, not of the pieces necessarily not fitting together, but mostly of the pieces not knowing each other. They were never able to, like, you know, grow into a relationship. But it's sort of like, you know, it's like either you fall in love. You don't learn how to, like, be in love with somebody. Like, either you fall in love or you don't, right? Like, it's an absolute. And I think the Clippers suffered from some of that. I do wonder, you know, if, like, who they'll call on. And I think they will call on some people. Like, I mean, I mentioned a name already. I've heard some league people kind of say, like, you know, they should check in on Kyle Lowry. Mm. And see. You know what I mean? Like, that's somebody that they absolutely could use. Now, what does that price tag look like? I don't know. Does Masai Ujiri and the Raptors want to help the Clippers after the Clippers took Kawhi Leonard and did so pretty publicly?
We can both agree that I don't think Masai is looking to help Lawrence Frank in any possible way, unless he's getting a king's ransom for him.
Well, and that's the thing, right? But, like, you know, I think that the Clippers – anybody who, like, if the Clippers decide they have to do something, I mean, again, they're gonna pay premium, right? Just because everybody knows their leverage, everybody knows what the clock is on this. So it is interesting. I mean, I do think, you know, bringing back Montrezl Harrell, bringing back, you know, maybe even Jermichael Green, Marcus Morris, certainly, that's a version of what they could do. I do think that they need. I mean, this is a team that essentially functions without a traditional-ish point guard. Hmm. You know, finding somebody to do that, I think, would be really, really helpful for this team, finding another playmaker so that that's not a Lou Williams job, that's not a Kawhi Leonard job or a Paul George job, that it's somebody else. That would be really, really helpful for this team. But, look, I mean, good point guards are expensive. They're not everywhere. I don't know exactly who that would be. And ideally, you'd want this to be somebody with a voice. And, again, those options are limited, and they normally come with really big price tags. And, look, the types of players the Clippers can acquire are going to mostly be either be older players or, older players, guys that are about to get paid a contract, or guys that are already in the middle of a huge deal, right? So it's not going to, like, it's sort of, they're not shopping from, like, the normal shelves here, right, Chris? Like, they're going to be shopping the cans are going to be dented a little bit, right? And they're just going to have to hope to make it work out right.
How much pressure is on Doc Rivers next year? Because every year that passes, Dan, you get further and further away from that Boston championship. And
yep.
The questions come up. I mean, if you've got the talent to win a championship, some of that blame falls on the head coach.
His situation with the Clippers is so unique, I think, in a lot of ways, because, you know, look, and within the organization, he absolutely has his detractors. But, I mean, look at the amount of just sort of presence he had here in dealing with, you know, the fight for social justice, like how prominent his voice was. And I think that holds value in an organization that, like, you know, has never really had a consistent voice worth listening to. You know, in a lot of ways, he's sort of the third star on the Clippers, and he's definitely the most vocal. You know what I mean? And the most sort of like forward-facing person in the franchise. So replacing Doc Rivers, you know, and doing it with somebody that you might feel is like a better tactician or something like that, would be great in games, but it also has some sort of drawbacks, I think, in terms of sort of the overall package as to what Doc Rivers gives the organization, particularly, by the way, as they get ready to move into a new building here in 4 years, assuming that we're all still here in 4 years.
4 years seems like a lifetime.
I know. It's a big assumption, I know, but maybe eventually there may be a basketball building in Inglewood that the Clippers play in that they would like to have people attend games at and cheer for names that they know and recognize. I think that certainly for all of Doc Rivers' shortcomings, I think sometimes too beholden to his rotations, definitely did not make the bigger adjustments, I think, that were necessary in this series. But in his defense, I would also say that, you don't expect your stars to just totally disappear either. And, you know, you don't expect your team to completely tighten up in these situations. Maybe that's his fault. Maybe it's not, I don't know. You know, someone once told me that, like, if you don't know what's going on with the team and if you can't figure out what's wrong, you change the coach. Mm-hmm. Right? That's like if you don't have a good answer, then that's the answer. I do agree with you that I think, you know, if the team is on the court and they're healthier and they're together, that's one less excuse they have to make. And the question kind of becomes like, how good of an excuse we think that is. I think that combined with sort of the bubble absolves the Clippers a little bit for their shortcomings this postseason. But, these opportunities are really precious. And this wasn't just, you know, blowing a 3-1 lead because you got outplayed, in two of the games and you blew a lead in the other. Like, you know, they got outplayed in game 7. They blew game 5 and they blew game 6. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it happened twice and that it happened twice in a row and no players or no coaches could stop it from happening, to me, would be very concerning if I'm Steve Ballmer and this is what I've, you know, put a lot of time and energy into.
Yeah, probably made things way too close in that first round series against Dallas. I mean, who knows how that series plays out if Porzingis is completely healthy. But, I mean, big season for everybody next year with the Clippers. Speaking of next season, Dan, Adam Silver, who has had to put out a bunch of fires this year, has had a very challenging 2020 when it comes to the pandemic, putting the league back together after the pandemic, dealing with a variety of social justice issues that have come up, including a brief time during the bubble. Adam Silver went on CNN and said this about next season.
My best guess is that even though, as you said, it'll be the 2021 season, that season won't start until 21. We said a week ago or so that the earliest we would start is Christmas of this year, but the more I'm learning, even listening to Dr. Fauci this morning, I continue to believe that we're going to be better off getting into January.
So Silver thinks that next season most likely won't start until January at the earliest. Anything you take away, Dan, from his comments?
Yeah, I think at the earliest is doing the heavy lifting in that statement. there is a lot of talk about next year here. After the Clippers were eliminated, I spoke with Kawhi Leonard about it, and Kawhi Leonard told me he didn't think they'd be back together until March. You know, that was his understanding. You hear other people say, yeah, it'd be great in January, but only if there's a vaccine and we can get comfortably get people into the seats. That to me, I think, is the thing to monitor most closely is how quickly are people attending indoor events and at what capacity are they attending them? You know, if will a building be able to get 15% or 20% attendance, you know, and it safely? And if so, I think, you know, we could have basketball in early February or maybe late January. If that is more towards the March, I think that then they'll wait, because getting people, you know, in the seats, getting fans in the stands, paying for parking, buying food and drinks and spending money on merchandise is a huge part of the league's business model, a huge part of individual teams' business models, especially for teams that own and operate their arenas and have been decimated because they don't have any concert dates. They don't have any, the circus can't come to town. There's nobody pro wrestling in your building or anything like that. You own a big chunk of empty land. Getting people in there, getting that back to work and having that revenue stream come back is very important. Especially, you know, for a handful of teams in this league that really need it. And I think that's why, I mean, to me, if I had to bet, I mean, it certainly seems like it'll be after the Super Bowl. You know, and I think the other thing, Chris, too, and, you know, you were here and is that every time you talk to a player about what next season's going to look like, the one thing they all say is that it's not going to look like this.
Yeah.
Like the bubble is a one-time thing. You know, like if there was a way to do like mini bubbles where there aren't extended quarantines and people can have family and do some stuff with rapid testing, like maybe people would be open to that, but that all feels like very last resort.
Yeah. Like, I think you're right. The idea of a bubble similar to this one is not going to happen. I think the players will have a lot of power in all this, but I think as Michelle Roberts has conveyed to the players, there's a lot of money on the table here. Like the NBA, mm-hmm. if they had their druthers, they'd come back around Christmas, probably in those mini bubbles, and they get, you know, the TV revenue flowing with them. They want to be back in buildings as much as anyone, but you know, they understand that the television revenue is pretty much it right now. And if players don't want to play, the NBA is going to say, all right, but, you know, it's X percent right off the top. Like, it's as simple as that. Like, we're not going to – you're only going to get a percentage of your salaries. And it's at that point, Dan, that I'll be curious to see how the players react. If they know it's going to be a significant chunk of their pay that just disappears if they don't want to start until February or March – does that change the mindset whatsoever? But players are going to have a lot of power. They're going to be able to dictate, you know, when they want to come back. Michelle Roberts, when I had a conversation with her over the summer, and I can't believe we're at the fall already, but when I had a conversation with her just a month or so ago, you know, she thought, you know, like you were saying, January, February, and you know, even March, I think, to your point, is on the table with this. I think the players are going to be able to wield a big bat when it comes to the date that they decide to return.
It seems like to me, and not to be a downer and by no stretch am I an expert on these things, to me, like, this seems to be like the quote unquote return to normal or the things that we're used to seeing and stuff like that. It certainly won't be next season. Like, next season is not going to look like a normal NBA season, whether that means less than 82 games, whether that means different types of travel, whether that means empty arenas or mostly empty arenas. That stuff, I think, is all – everybody kind of is on the same page on that stuff. Like, it's not going to be normal. How could it be? I think the trickier thing is, like you said, is you have a group of players who have had at least incredible leverage over the last few months. They were able to bring this league to its knees, and get commitments from owners for millions on millions of dollars, commitments to work together on causes that are important to the players. And I'll be curious to see if they can use that same kind of power and unity when it comes to a restart. That being said, I think you're right that ultimately, you know, what they came back for was to finish a season. All right. Starting one and running one is kind of its own different animal, and figuring out how to do that, figuring out the best ways to get everybody on board and to keep people on board, to keep people safe, to keep people healthy. The one thing that I feel good about, Chris, at least in terms of the future of this league, is like it does seem at least that like testing is getting easier, you know, and it feels sort of like there are ways that to detect this quicker, and the NBA has got all sorts of partnerships on that front. And I think with like rapid testing, like Adam Silver mentioned, even if it's for fans, is, you know what I mean, would be something they consider. But I think desperately they want to get butts in the seats here, right? And there are going to be a lot of people doing whatever they can to make sure that's a reality.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a top priority for the league, but who knows when they can make that happen. Dan, always appreciate it, man. Good to talk to you. Enjoy the remaining weeks you have inside the bubble. The outside world is a nice place to rejoin, I can tell you.
All right, started to lose Dan Wojcicki there at the end of our conversation, so I didn't get a chance to ask him about the big coaching news of this week, which is Billy Donovan taking the job with the Chicago Bulls. Donovan, of course, coming off a successful season in Oklahoma City. His contract expired, and he elected to part ways with the Thunder. It was not an acrimonious breakup. He just wanted to go in a different direction. That direction, it turns out, is Chicago. And I like this move for both Billy Donovan and the Chicago Bulls. The Bulls are not a contending team, at least not for the next couple of seasons, but they are a team with some direction. They're a team that has some solid young talent. It's Zach LaVine. It's Lauri Markkanen. It's Wendell Carter. I mean, these are good players. I don't know if there's a franchise player among them, but these are very good players. And as we look ahead to the following offseason, they're going to have some financial flexibility when some big contracts, specifically Otto Porter's, come off the books. So if they can stabilize the franchise, start to trend more in a positive direction, they'll have the ability to be opportunistic in free agency, go after the right guys, and start to build this from the ground up. And I can tell you that Donovan wasn't burnt out with coaching. He wasn't looking to take a year off when he left Oklahoma City. He just wanted to go to a team that had some direction. Remember, he took over in Oklahoma City when the Thunder were a team that had Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook and were competing to win a championship. In year two, he had Russell Westbrook, and he was trying to build out a team that really wasn't built to win anything substantial without a second star. He had some success there. Then it was Russell Westbrook and Paul George. And this past year, it's Chris Paul and a bunch of young guys. So I think Billy Donovan just wanted some direction on the team he was coaching. And Chicago, which is now under the auspices or under the umbrella of Arturas Karnasovich, the first-year top team president, they are a team that offered that kind of opportunity. And credit to the Bulls, they had cast a wide net in their interview search. Ime Udoka, the 76ers assistant coach, he was someone they liked. Steven Silas, the Dallas Mavericks assistant coach, he was someone they liked. But Billy Donovan is a proven coach. He is a coach that's good with young players dating back to his days at the University of Florida. He just made a lot of sense for these Chicago Bulls. So they get their man, and Billy Donovan gets a chance to coach a different team that will require some hand-holding, require some development to get to where they want to be. All right, that's it. As always, subscribe to the podcast over at Apple Podcast. Rate, review as well. We'll see you next week.